make us start, a warm welcome to everyone, and particularly to Joseph Flores. Joseph is a fourth year doctoral student here at Cambridge, and his thesis is on Pentecostal social thought and action, La Misión Inglesa Pentecostal, I say my best Spanish accent, and militarism in Chile at 1973 to 1990. And today, as it says here, he's speaking to us on giving life to the faith, Pentecostal practice and community in authoritarian Chile. We'll hand directly over to Joseph, but just to remind you that there will be refreshments afterwards downstairs.
So first, I just want to thank Jesse and Emma for the opportunity to speak tonight. And as Emma mentioned, I'll be speaking on Pentecostal practice and community in authoritarian Chile. So throughout my presentation, I want to focus on two guiding questions. How did Pentecostals frame understandings of what constituted community, in which believers shared the experiences of conflict, violence, and poverty of their fellow citizens? And in what way did these understandings inflect individual subjectivities and responses to the context of the military regime? Now, using oral histories I gathered from the members of the Misión Iglesia Pentecostal, or the Pentecostal Mission Church in Chile, I will argue that in the context of authoritarian Chile, where violence and conflict became part of everyday life, and urgency and necessity were the impetus of new practice and thought, traditional boundaries between the church and its surrounding communities became more fluid, but also more contested. What this meant for believers was a slow reworking of what they so often refer to as their role in, quote, God's plan for humanity. What exactly this meant varied depending on individual circumstances, but what became clear over the course of my research was that their interpretation of their community became more inclusive and expansive. Looking at Pentecostalism in the zone of crisis, which is a term used in Latin American historiography, I think will force us to take or reconsider not only interpretations of Pentecostal subjectivities as intrinsically hermetic or self-removed from the world, but also acknowledge the enormous creativity and flexibility within the movement to adapt to and shape its local context. But before I delve into this, I want to begin with a short introduction on the religious geography of Latin America. I'm really not sure how familiar everyone here today is with the region. And I think that there's still an assumption and within a lot of observers that Latin America is synonymous with the Roman Catholic Church. But I also want to suggest that this has changed significantly. You can see there are categories predominantly Catholic, majority Catholic, half Catholic, and less Catholic. Within Protestantism, and I'll get to this in a minute, are usually grouped Pentecostals, even Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, anyone that is not Catholic and Christian. We can see that in countries like Mexico and Paraguay, for example, Catholics remain the vast majority, and Protestants have made little inroads. There are many reasons for this, but in the case of Mexico, for example, scholars have pointed to its proximity to the United States and the often contentious relationship that exists there, and the idea that Protestantism is an imported North American religion. It's also been suggested that the almost uninterrupted informal alliance between Mexico's governing party, which has up until 2000 ruled for nearly 71 years, and the Catholic Church also blunted new religious growth. On the other side of the spectrum are the countries in Central America, where mainly Pentecostals churches now account for almost half of the population. Again, reasons for this are complex and dense, but it has been suggested that the continued state of internal warfare, increasing economic inequality, human rights violations, and daily violence that permeated these countries beginning in the 1960s opened up space for a turn to charismatic, revivalistic religion. So why Chile? Why have I chosen Chile to talk about this movement? And as you can see, it falls somewhere in the middle. It's still a majority Catholic country, but Protestantism has grown quite significantly, as well as the number of people unaffiliated. According to the 2012 census, 17% of the population was Protestant, and that's approximately 2.2 million people. But 90% of these churches are Pentecostal. And as you can see, this growth has occurred in less than, or just over 100 years. So it's quite impressive. Also, the violence during the period is pretty much well documented, and debates about how to interpret the events of the dictatorship are still very much a part of national and local discussions. I also wanted to point out how I'm using terms like Protestant, Evangelical, and Pentecostal, because I think that they can appear very fluid in Latin America. The term Evangelico, or Evangelical, is often used to talk about all non-Catholic Christian groups, and like I said earlier, these are Protestants, Pentecostals, as well as Evangelicals is defined in North American and European sense. The term is an amic or local description, and I pretty much follow this suit throughout my presentation, although when talking about Pentecostalism, I'll refer to the group specifically. Most, but not all, of Pentecostal growth in Chile has come in the peripheries of the major urban centers like Santiago and Concepcion in the south. There is definitely a rural element to this growth, but for the sake of time here today, I'll just be focusing on Santiago. If you look at this map in the upper right-hand corner, are the kind of the well-to-do upper-class sectors of the city. According to the 2010 report issued by the Chilean Congress, the neighborhoods here in the pink and purple had the highest median household incomes in all of Chile, and together they represent nearly 60% of GNP of the entire country. So you can really see how unequal the living situation is in Chile. The Gini coefficient is one of the highest in the world. Now, what does this really have to do with Pentecostals? And I want to show that historically, Pentecostalism has grown in the areas along the edges of the urban centers, in the working class and industrial margins. And here, this would be in the yellow, kind of green, dark blue areas. And I'll come back to this in a minute. But what I really want to point out is that these understanding these areas and kind of the lived situation of these areas is key to thinking about how Pentecostalism embraced their faith during this period. In the 1950s and 60s, just as Chile was embarking on a radical reorganization of its economic strategy toward the production of basic goods within the country, and this was primarily to offset Europe's slowing demand for raw materials after World War II, factories and plants began to grow up on the periphery of Santiago and other urban areas. Now, this interpretation is widely credited to sociologists Christian Lalive de Epinay and Emilio Willems. Both scholars borrow generously from Durkheim's concept of anomie, which is displaced norms and attitudes in unstable life conditions, to suggest it was the physical insecurities of the processes of rapid industrialization and migration that drove the initial wave of Pentecostal conversion. Lalive de Epinay and Willems both see Pentecostalism as an answer to this social state of wayfaring. While more recent studies, including those by David Martin and Martin Lintard, have criticized these interpretations for ignoring the characteristics and internal dynamics that make Pentecostalism attractive to so many, I think it is clear that the everyday experience of uncertainty that accompanied the transitions of migrants from rural to urban areas did play a significant role in their search for new systems of meanings. But I really want to take point with the second assumption within these works, the being Pentecostal, and by that I mean living as a Pentecostal after conversion, necessarily inculcates a retreat from the world and whether or not this is even possible. I'm particularly interested in Lalive de Epinay's conclusions, which he suggests that Pentecostalism reproduces the authoritarian structures of the hacienda or the plantation system that existed throughout Chile and was its primary source of income just up until the end of World War II. He thinks that the Pentecostal churches are a continuation of the traditional patron-client social mores that existed. For this reason, he also thinks that it's a check on modernization and democratization. But what I'm really most concerned with is his idea that what he calls Pentecostalism as a haven of the masses. His work is very much in the tradition of social science in the 60s and early 70s, where analyses of religion were explicitly reductionist, looking for underlying causes that religion only directly expressed. This was especially true, I think, of ideas in Latin America during the period when Marxist thinking and action of and ideas of class dominated many discussions. Now, my point here is not so much that structural and functional interpretations direct attention to broad social shifts, or that Pentecostal's agency to redress problems that surround these processes is neglected. This has been done very well in other studies, and I'd be happy to talk more about this at the end if you have any questions. What I hope to demonstrate here is that the definitions of these categories were also open to change, as Pentecostals found themselves confronting new and complex situations like Chile's military dictatorship. I will focus on transformations of Pentecostal practice and notions of community, and it will become clear that these changes were not mere reflections of structural shifts. Rather, they were highly contested categories about what it meant to be religious and what boundary blurring and border crossing improvisations believers deemed were necessary to find meaning in the context of life under authoritarian rule. To look at these type of everyday experiences, I gathered oral histories from the members of the Pentecostal Mission Church in Chile, which I'll refer to as the MIP throughout the rest of the presentation. The church is based in Santiago, but has congregations spread across most of central Chile. There's a total of 19 congregations, and around, there aren't exact figures, but around 4,000 members today. As is common among Pentecostal churches, the MIP was born from a schism in 1952. The conflict arose after the nomination of a pastor to replace the church's ailing superintendent. MIP leaders said the action was not planned, but the mother church to this day claims it was a struggle for power. It's well documented in the literature that sectarianism was and continues to be a constant among Pentecostal churches, and disagreements about leadership roles are common. This is in part explained by Pentecostalism's emphasis on the priesthood of all believers, which meant that religious authority rests with individuals and not institutions. Socioeconomically, the MIP membership mirrored its working class surroundings. Its members were street vendors, domestic workers, casual laborers, or they worked in the factories and industrial parks in their neighborhoods. Life in these areas was difficult. Many traveled long distance to work without public transportation, others struggled to find stable employment. But as one Chilean scholar notes, and I think it's important to point out, there was also a dense fabric of marginal networks that churned against the dominant system in these areas. Now, I'll return to this point later, but what I want to make it clear that this was the social reality that characterized Pentecostals' everyday experience. By 1963, just over a decade since its founding, the church included 18 congregations, 40 branches, and nearly 10,000 members. So it had experienced quite impressive growth. Santiago continued to remain its stronghold, but it did experience significant growth in southern Chile. And still, most of the new congregations were located in lower middle class neighborhoods, whether this was rural or urban. Now, the original statutes of the church revealed the seeds of its particular form of Pentecostalism. The MIP presented itself as explicitly non-sectarian, puertas abiertas, or open doors. According to one member who I spoke to who was present at the time of the schism, the move was meant to rid the church of its denominational pride and establish that the church would maintain communion with all churches that shared the same principles. Unlike the majority of Pentecostal churches, the MIP was also altogether more egalitarian. The church's statutes gave a formal say in church administration to all members who could be elected by the General Assembly onto the church directorate, the highest executive organization of the church. And this continues to this day. Initially, this applied to only male members, but in the 1970s was open to include female congregants as well. Nearly 10 years later, the same body voted to extend the right to join the ministry to female members, being one of the first Pentecostal churches in Chile to do so. Another difference, and this will become important later, was the MIP's growing interest in collaboration with other Christian churches. But I should point out that this did not reflect a concern for social responsibility and service. There was little reference to these issues in MIP documents prior to the early 1960s, though it did become involved in several interfaith and interdenominational groups. The MIP's early collaboration with various groups reflected an attempt to bring its interpretation of the gospel, its hermeneutics, into contact with the wider world. The theme of ecumenism, however, was still rather rudimentary. The defining moment in the MIP's ecumenical history, without doubt, was its decision to join the World Council of Churches in 1961. Most Pentel groups then, and still today, view the WCC as representative of what I've heard quoted as the apostate liberal churches, too focused on secular or worldly matters with little concern for doctrinal hermeneutics. Initial contact with the World Council of Churches was made through an MIP member during a missionary trip to Uruguay. And there he met Methodist pastor Emilio Castro, who later became the general secretary of the World Council of Churches. MIP members also emphasized that its association with the WCC was viewed as an extension of its open door policy. Yet confirmation of the relationship was by no means a foregone conclusion. Such a decision required confirmation by member delegates at the church's annual conference, and church leaders could not move ahead with the application process. And I, looking at the documents from the WCC and the letters going back and forth, this proved quite a bit of tension between the WCC and this church. The WCC was looking to make inroads into Pentecostal churches at the time, and this delay, well, it didn't make them happy, to say the least. Regardless, the motion was passed, and the church, the MIP membership was approved by the Constituent Assembly of the WCC at its New Delhi Conference in 1961, thus becoming one of the first Pentecostal churches to join the ecumenical organization. It did so with another Chilean Pentecostal church, and those two together were the first Pentecostal churches. Younger members, probably because of this relationship with the WCC, were also highly influenced and encouraged by their study abroad. Many with scholarships from Geneva, many traveled to ISEDET, which I'm not sure if anyone here is familiar with, in Buenos Aires. It's the Evangelical Superior Institute for Theological Studies. And a lot of these students came into contact with theologians like René Padilla, José Miguel Bonino, both of whom were highly influential in articulating a Protestant counterpart to Catholicism's liberation theology. As these young leaders returned home to their congregations, they began to advocate a reading of the Bible that focused on the liberating power of Christ and the need to address worldly problems through social engagement. Now, I want to highlight that when members spoke of ecumenism and social service, they were referring to a search for what they quoted to me as a unity in Christ, rather than solidarity or social responsibility. Their participation in interfaith and ecumenical organizations was meant to shore up and reaffirm their solidarity with Christ and his message, not their fellow citizens. Now, this began to shift in the late 1960s. Part of this is due to the social and political climate in Chile, and MIP leaders were encouraged to attempt to propagate new forms of social work. As I said, the social political climate of Chile during the 1960s and the Christian Democratic Program of Participatory Democracy promised to address many of Chile's most pressing social deficits through deep reforms in issues, you know, surrounding housing, education, property, and inequality. In hindsight, the government's plan was probably too ambitious. Throughout the period, government agencies redistributed nearly a quarter of all cultivated land, brought the rural minimum wage in line with its urban levels, and constructed nearly a quarter of a million new homes in Chile. Reflecting this change, the MIP turned to biblical interpretation for inspiration and justification of its growing concern for social action. Drawing from James 2, verse 14 through 20, the leaders of the church declared at the 1965 annual conference that the social responsibility of the church is fully justified in the attempt to establish the best conditions for the proclamation of the gospel. These conditions not only compromise the freedom and right of proclamation, but also for better social circumstances in the actual world in order to increase susceptibility to the gospel. On the other hand, the social action should also be a consequence of the new life of the believers, producing good fruits and maintaining a living faith, which is translated into works. Now, translating their faith into works was also given social and political space through the government's revolution in liberty that opened new space by incorporating previously marginalized groups into the political fold through neighborhood councils, labor unions, youth groups, mother centers, sports associations, and many more. By 1970, there were nearly 20,000 organizations of these types. Yet leftist parties, driven by the ideological currents of the Cuban Revolution and Vatican II, viewed the reforms as slow and incomplete and called for even more radical change. Moreover, Chile's old economic dilemmas continued. Slow growth, rapid inflation, and extreme wage fluctuations. The result was an extreme polarization across the political spectrum. Both the right and the left became more entrenched. In the working class neighborhoods and shanty towns where Pentecostals overwhelmingly resided, leftist rhetoric and emotion became more urgent, more salient. Conservative sectors undoubtedly saw this as proof that the nation was on the precipice of ruin. The election of Salvador Allende by a plurality of vote reflected the contested nature of Chilean social and political life. Instantly, his Chilean road to socialism, as he called it, created a genuine climate of uncertainty in the country. Radical change was on the horizon, though few expected its arrival or its ferocity. So very quickly, for those of you who aren't familiar, some of you might have seen these images, others you might not have, but this video kind of reflects the events that Chileans woke up to on the morning of September 11th, 1973. And I think you can judge for yourself, but I think you can understand that it was particularly traumatic for many people. So this is the Capitol building in Santiago. President Salvador Allende is still inside. So the repression in Chile at the time under the direction of Augusto Pinochet was based in a doctrine of national salvation, but it was quite large in scale and very much layered in its implementation. According to the 2010 report issued by the National Commission on Political Imprisonment and Torture, individually proved cases of death or disappearance were around 2,000. Truth or imprisonment, the numbers were around 40,000, and exiles, there were around 200,000. I'm not sure if any of you have seen the documentary Hora Chilena. It was actually released in Cambridge a few years ago and tracks the lives of several Chilean immigrants that came to Cambridge.
Sorry, what's it called?
Hora Chilena, H-O-R-A, Chilena. It's very good, and I highly recommend it. So I think these numbers show that